This is Radio Boston. I'm Sharon Brody in for Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. We begin today with our week in review with new information about the FBI's fatal shooting of an Orlando man linked to marathon bombing suspect Tamerlan Tsarnaev.
We received confirmation that he was, in fact, unarmed when he was shot seven times, once in the head.
Also this week, to protect its fishing industry, Massachusetts pushes back against new, stricter federal catch limits.
NOAA's new regulations are essentially a death penalty on the fishing industry in Massachusetts as we know it.
And the state auditor raises questions about welfare fraud, and the Patrick administration raises questions about the state auditor's report.
The audit report has an error rate that's just astonishing.
And with less than a month to go before the special Senate election, the candidates spar over taxes.
With Markey in the Senate, you'll have high taxes delivered directly to your door.
And Gabriel Gomez, he refuses to ask millionaires like himself to pay their fair share.
And we'll discuss these stories with our Week in Review panel. Joining us now is Callum Borchers, business reporter for the Boston Globe. Hey, Callum, happy Friday. Good to have you.
Likewise. Great to be here, Anthony.
And with us as well, John Carroll, communications professor for Boston University and the blogger behind CampaignOutsider.com. Hey, John, great to see you.
Good to be here.
So let's start with who knew what when about Boston Marathon bombing suspect Tamerlan Tsarnaev, who died after a shootout with police after the bombing. Russian intelligence officials say they gave U.S. authorities detailed information about Tsarnaev wanting to join an Islamic insurgency. And if U.S. authorities had acted on that information, they might have been able to prevent the bombings. That information comes from Massachusetts Congressman William Keating, who met this week with intelligence officials in Russia. Now, we already knew that back in 2011, the FBI spent 3 months investigating Tsarnaev because of a request from Russian authorities, but the Bureau decided he wasn't a threat. But according to Keating, the Russians showed him intelligence that was very specific about Tsarnaev's efforts to become involved in activities that should have prompted U.S. authorities to take the threat more seriously. Callum, what does this new information add to our understanding of this very complicated story?
I think, unfortunately, it really adds more questions, really. Mm. But I think that the biggest question for me, as I've looked at this, is more to do with the period between the bombings and actually the shootout on Friday and the eventual apprehension of Johar Tsarnaev. It's that gap that I find particularly troubling, which is that we know that Tsarnaev was on the FBI's radar beforehand, and it's easy to understand how with the mass quantities of tips that they receive, it would be difficult to perhaps anticipate and prevent beforehand. But the fact that it took so long to identify him after the fact, you know, we heard earlier this week, too, his mother, you know, who has come up with all these conspiracy theories. But one point that she did make that I thought actually had some validity for a change was that, you know, how could he do this if the FBI was monitoring him? And I think that's a very fair question.
Mm. John, what do you hear in this story?
Well, I'm not sure I want to blame the FBI for this, but I think that this story is like Russian nesting dolls. Every time you open one up, you get another smaller piece of information. And I think part of the problem is there's too much information. This is a great era of data collection, but nobody seems to have figured out how exactly to prioritize the data so that the most important stuff rises to the top. Mm. So were there oversights here? Undoubtedly. Even the intelligence officials here in the U.S. said, we're not going to dispute what Keating said and what the Russians said. But how much can you reasonably expect in this area? It's really hard to say.
Yeah, because, I mean, on the one hand, the FBI perhaps didn't pursue the information or didn't do as good a job connecting the dots as they might have. But Tsarnaev did end up on a terrorist watch list. So isn't the problem that there are thousands of people on these watch lists? Law enforcement can't track everyone all the time. So even if they know that there's a possibility that someone could do something wrong, it still doesn't really get you all the way there.
No, it doesn't. I think he moved up from a list of hundreds of thousands to a list of tens of thousands. But unless you get onto the big list, the terror watch list and the no-fly list. A lot of times you're just going to stay below the radar, and that's what happened here.
Well, let's move on to another really troubling piece of this story. It's the killing of Ibrahim Todashev in Florida last week during an interrogation by a team of FBI agents and Massachusetts State Police officers. Todashev was an associate of Tamerlan Tsarnaev. He had apparently implicated himself and Tsarnaev in a triple murder back in 2011. We first heard that he lunged with a knife at one of the cops with a knife who shot him dead. Now we've heard that he was apparently unarmed, and his father, Abdul Baki Todashev, is alleging that he was executed. Here he is speaking through a translator to CNN.
At the moment, I want justice, and I want there to be an investigation, so that these people are tried under American law. These are not FBI agents, but bandits. I cannot call them anything else, and they must be tried.
Now, the FBI won't comment other than to say they're conducting an internal review of what happened. But Cal, let me come to you first. What do you make of this bizarre twist in an already very troubling story?
Yeah, it's very bizarre, and we have so many different versions of how that played out in Orlando. Was it a blade as in a knife? Was it a sword? Was he completely unarmed? Was it a pole? We've heard all of these different things. You know, there's certainly a lot of questions to be asked, including the fact that he was apparently shot seven times, which is a very high number. Assuming that you were trying to, you know, let's assume that he is attacking you, you would think that the FBI's first response would be to wound him, but to try to keep him alive. When you remember, think about the great pains that they went to not to kill Johar Tsarnaev during that entire manhunt, with the purpose being we want to take him into custody alive so that he can answer questions. And that would seem to be the priority here. So I think that obviously this accusation that it was execution style, you know, there's going to be a pretty high burden of proof on something as serious as that. But nevertheless, there's a lot of questions that the FBI has to answer here, I think.
Yeah, John, and I'm always uneasy trying to second guess what cops do when they're dealing with life and death situations. But without a clear explanation, and we haven't had one yet, one does wonder how investigators could sit down with someone who they knew was potentially dangerous and put themselves in a situation where they ended up killing them.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't help that law enforcement's produced more stories than John Updike at this point. But I think the stories are starting to sync up a little bit now. And a report in the New York Times yesterday and a report by CBS News today seem to have the same sort of version. And the CBS News report, which is by John Miller, who's a former deputy director of the FBI and who's a normally highly reliable source, he says that it was clear that Todashev was getting agitated. One of the state police, I think, Massachusetts detectives, didn't want to say something aloud. So he texted to the FBI agent who was questioning, saying, watch out, this guy's getting agitated. As the FBI agent looked down to read the text, according to this version of the story, the table went over, the whole thing erupted. And the reason given in this version that the detective who was in the room didn't draw his firearm and shoot was that it was too close quarters and there would have been a crossfire. It would have put the FBI agent in danger. So I don't know if that helps or hurts, but it certainly adds a bizarre twist to the story that people are texting back and forth to each other in the same room.
A bizarre twist indeed. Don't text while driving. Don't text while interrogating dangerous people.
Excellent rule.
Well, let's move on to the state of Massachusetts and its fishing industry. Yesterday, Attorney General Martha Coakley announced that she is filing suit against the Obama administration. At issue, she says, are new stricter catch limits that she says will devastate the local fishing industry.
We believe and we allege in this suit that this dire economic impact must be considered and that NOAA must take steps to mitigate that harm. We allege that they totally ignored this impact.
But here's Peter Baker, who heads the Northeast Fisheries Program for the Pew Charitable Trust. When we spoke to him yesterday, he told us the catch limits are necessary because groundfish stocks have been so overfished, they're now at historically low levels.
Less fish in the short term will create economic hardship, but I would say that the short-term economic hardship will pale in comparison to the long-term economic hardship of driving these stocks into commercial extinction, which is what we're on the verge of doing.
So it's an old story, of course, too many boats chasing too few fish. The state of Massachusetts lining up with the fishing industry against the federal government. Callum, what do you make of this lawsuit?
Well, it's tricky because, you know, my initial reaction is to sort of echo what we just heard, that it, perhaps it's a little bit short-sighted. Obviously, you know, tighter catch limits this year does, you know, cause some pain in the short term. But, hey, if you overfish and they go away altogether, then, you know, you're not going to have any, you know, longevity whatsoever. But I understand the frustration as well because, remember, they're saying that this science was faulty. That's what we heard from Attorney General Coakley. And, you know, she's got a great point. I mean, you look back at 2008 when the scientists conducted this assessment on cod, and it was very promising, right? It looked like the population was thriving. It was going to rebuild very steadily. And then just 3 years later, you get another assessment that's totally inconsistent with the first one, showing a totally depleted stock, and that is really what's driving these stricter catch limits. So for the fishermen, they've got to be frustrated. You know, you told me a few years ago that things were fine, and now you're telling me it's dire.
Hmm. John, it really sounds like, you know, a disagreement between a long-term view versus a short-term view. I mean, the long-term about the health of the fisheries. But in the short term, you're really talking about people's livelihood. I mean, it's a tricky issue here, isn't it?
Yeah, and the debate is over whether the ocean is half empty or half full. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's science on the other side that challenges Coakley's characterization of the science that NOAA used. Each side has its own statistics. Each side has its own view of the scientific evidence in terms of where the fisheries stand right now. I think that there's another aspect to this, though, that makes it a little more complicated. Martha Coakley talked about a level of dysfunction and distrust between the fishermen and the agency. I think the fishermen go further and say this is vindictive because they have pushed back so many times, and they actually have gotten money back because of excessive fines in the past. Mm. And they say there's a vindictive edge to this as well. And that adds something that I think is a little harder to negotiate in a lot of ways.
I'm just wondering, Calvin, this is a really hard question, but I mean, is there a middle ground here in some way? Because, I mean, it seems like such a zero-sum game when you're talking about these kinds of limits on catches that are really going to end so many people's, you know, careers and jobs and the way they've made their livelihood for generations.
Well, I think that's a great point, Anthony. I mean, you'd like to see some type of perhaps more gradual decline. I mean, the restriction we're talking about for this year is 78% below what it was a year ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a huge drop-off for 1 year. Obviously, if you're NOAA, you do want to take this long-term view, but is there a way to cut it by, you know, a third this year and another third next year so more gradually we get to that point? I mean, when you take three quarters out in one fell swoop, that's a lot for any industry to absorb.
Mm. They did, just to add this, they did raise the quota on other fish. So they reduced
Correct.
The quota on cod and yellowtail, flounder and haddock. But they raised it on redfish and pollock and white hake. But only by 15%. So in a way, they're taking with one hand and giving back a little bit with the other hand, but it doesn't really seem to balance out.
Well, let's move on quickly to concerns about allegations of welfare abuse at the Department of Transitional Assistance. In a report this week, State Auditor Suzanne Bump identified more than 1,100 welfare recipients in the Commonwealth who are dead. If true, that would mean somebody or some people have fraudulently pocketed almost $2.4 million in state benefits. She raised other concerns about the department as well. Now, we spoke this week to the interim commissioner for the Department of Transitional Assistance, Stacey Monahan, who took issue with the report and said that it included names who should have been cut off, she admitted, but it also included names that had already been dropped. It included duplicate names, names of people who were not dead. And here's Governor Deval Patrick, who says the report greatly exaggerated the problem.
The audit report has an error rate that's just astonishing. It's a serious problem without being exaggerated. But I think the other part of it is that 99.9% of the money that taxpayers spend on DTA benefits are properly spent.
So, Callum, 99.9% of the money is being properly spent. The auditor saying not so. Where's the truth in this? How do we get to that?
Well, apparently it would be somewhere in between. I mean, we've got this batch of, right, 1,100 supposedly dead people still receiving benefits, but then you parse it out to the sample, you know, that of 178 and something like 17 of those are actually, you know, verifiable dead cases. Well, you're talking about, you know, as the governor said, a very high error rate. That's about 90%. So are we talking about 1,100 people or 110 people? And that's a huge difference. Now, as has been said over and over in this case, you know, one case case of fraud is one too many. However, you know, this is serious, but we want to have a real understanding of what the scope is, and I don't think the audit report gives us that.
Interesting. Yeah, what do you think, John?
If you look at the raw numbers, you have to believe that this is a small problem. I mean, even if you take 1,100 dead welfare benefit recipients, you know, you're talking about out of 885,000 people who receive some kind of welfare benefits in the state of Massachusetts. Even if you take the $18 million figure, you're talking out of $1.7 billion that the state spends on its welfare program. So I think when you put it in that context, you see that this is a problem, but it's a relatively small problem. The biggest problem for Deval Patrick and the state, and especially the Department of Transitional Assistance, is that this is mother's milk to talk radio, to the Boston Herald. I mean, they are just going to town on this and will continue to until the Whitey Bulger trial starts.
Mother's milk, you mean allegations of welfare fraud.
They have blown this out on the front page for 3 days now, and it plays right into what the Herald does. Mm. So when you look at the sort of the ramped up emotion about this, I mean, part of it is that people don't like to see their tax dollars wasted. Part of it is this sort of hyperventilating that's been going on in certain sections of the media.
Well, let's move on to the Senate race. Speaking of hyperventilating, with less than 1 month to go before the special U.S. Senate election in Massachusetts, and this week, dueling ads on taxes. Here's the one from the Democrat, Congressman Ed Markey, accusing Republican Gabriel Gomez of protecting the rich.
Ed Markey wants fairness in our taxes. That's why he's foreclosing corporate tax loopholes and passing the Warren Buffett rule, making millionaires pay the same tax rate as the middle class. And Gabriel Gomez?
We've already raised taxes on the top 2%.
He refuses to ask millionaires like himself to pay their fair share.
And here's a snippet from an ad by the National Republican Senatorial Committee, an infomercial-style web video accusing Markey of being addicted to taxes.
Has this ever happened to you? You're looking at your paycheck wondering how much more taxes you can pay. Will it ever get easier? Well, today's your lucky day. For an unlimited time, it seems Ed Markey will vote in favor of higher taxes. Don't wait. Vote for Ed Markey and raise your taxes today.
So there you go. John, you're a veteran ad man. What do those ads say about where this race stands?
Well, take the second one first. That's what we used to call a concept with a capital K in the ad agency I worked at. I mean, this is Republicans don't do humor all that well. A lot of people don't do humor all that well. Mm. But this is so cheesy in so many ways. And the other problem with it is Gabriel Gomez is going around trying to distance himself from the national GOP. He's looking at trying to avoid what happened to Scott Brown in his rematch with Elizabeth Warren. This is a video created by the National Republican Senatorial Committee. So at one time, you know, he's holding them off on the one hand. On the other hand, he's approving these kinds of web videos and ads from the Massachusetts Republican Party. He's sort of looking to have it both ways. As far as Markey goes, I mean, there's nothing like some good class warfare. Hmm. And Ed Markey is a master of that.
Well, Callum, less than a month to go, the first debate between these two, apparently it's going to be the only debate, if I understand that correctly, next Wednesday. How important is this debate? And what do you expect? What are you looking to hear?
Well, if it does wind up being the only one, it, of course, becomes tremendously important. And I think it's most important for Gabriel Gomez, who is still, I think, sort of defining himself. And you really heard that in that sort of warring commercials, is how are we going to define this Gabriel Gomez? Is he an independent thinker in the mold of Scott Brown, or is he so easily tied to the national GOP? And I think that that's going to be a big moment for him next week in this debate, is where does he come down? And also, how does he, you know, respond to debating a much more experienced politician? There were moments in the GOP debates where he seemed a little bit flustered, and, you know, who could blame him? He was inexperienced. But now he's got a little bit more seasoning, and this is his moment to shine and have a coming out party if he steps up.
I think that's going to be a really interesting. So again, that's Wednesday night, the first debate between Gabriel Gomez and Ed Markey. Folks, let's move on to our hubbub, that story that didn't quite make it above the fold this week, that small story perhaps that is yet still important. And Sharon Brody, let me bring you back into this conversation. Give us your hubbub.
All right. My hubbub is about beer and penguins. Because, as we all know, the purpose of sports is to pit entire populations of cities against each other in brutal and unflinching warfare. So we have this story reported by the Puck Daddy blog on Yahoo. Howler's Coyote Cafe in Pittsburgh has issued what it calls a public service announcement that it will not be serving any Boston beers during the Eastern Conference Finals. And if patrons want to drink Sam Adams, then they will need to drink up before the Bruins series starts tomorrow. And I say all's fair in love and hockey, but an awful lot of Sam Adams is indeed brewed in Pennsylvania.
Pittsburgh, actually.
Yeah? Right? Oh, no, actually, no. I think it's over closer to Philly. But, right. You know, it's Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Good point. All right, John, your hubbub.
Okay, well, after years of being blocked by Mayor Tom Menino, Walmart actually made it into Boston this past week. Although, actually, they only made it into the Boston Globe. They ran an ad that urged Boston shoppers to compare Walmart's prices to Stop and Shop's prices. And so it had two grocery lists and said you can save 23% at Walmart. The weird thing was this is aimed at Boston shoppers. The Walmart was located in North Oxford. The Stop and Shop was located in Worcester. I'm not quite sure what this ad is trying to tell Boston residents, that we should shop in North Oxford. And don't get me wrong, I love the people of North Oxford. or that we should lobby for Walmart to come into Boston. I mean, I'm not really sure what the actual purpose of this was, but it was good to see them in town anyway.
All right. Might be as close as they'll get for a while anyway.
Yeah, probably.
Callum, your hubbub.
Well, I, like a lot of sports fans, am experiencing something of Rutgers fatigue lately. And after the Mike Rice debacle with that basketball coach hurling basketballs at his players and, you know, slurring them in all sorts of offensive ways, we had a sort of follow-up story that has gotten much less play a couple of weeks ago. The new athletic director at Rutgers, Julie Herman, has been accused of similar bad behavior, not the basketball throwing, but verbal abuse in previous jobs as a volleyball coach at Louisville and Tennessee. And it's still a bit murky as to what that background is, but I think it's an interesting eye-opener, and my hope is that it will sort of start a conversation that reminds us that this type of behavior isn't confined to men's sports, and it's not confined to men's coaches either.
Hmm. Well, here's my hubbub, and it's interesting. I really enjoyed working with you this week, Sharon, but because we've been joined at the hip for much of the week, it turns out we both have hubbubs about beer. So here's my hubbub.
Surprise!
It comes from a small item in Boston Magazine that I want to talk about. It's about the Great American Beer or Pabst Blue Ribbon, and in case you hadn't noticed, the PBR brand has been embraced in a big way by that urban hipster culture, along with tattoos and fixed gear bikes and everything else that is cool and retro. But the thing about PBR, even the beer industry refers to it as sub-premium, and some people might think that that just means not very good beer, as opposed to all those fancy ultra-premium craft-brewed beers. But it's cheap, and because Pabst, or it's been cheap, and here's the point, because it's been embraced in such a big way, the price is skyrocketing. According to data compiled by Restaurant Sciences, a Newton-based firm that tracks food and beverage sales, the price of a Pabst Blue Ribbon has been going steadily up over the past several years. Even the stock is soaring. It's up more than 26% last year, which is sort of ironic. I mean, weren't people embracing this sub-premium beer because it was cool, retro, and cheap? Well, apparently it's not so cheap. It is sub-premium with an increasingly premium price. So that's where I'm going to end this week in review.
Let them drink it in Pittsburgh.
Right. No Sam Adams will give them PBR. Callum Borchers, business reporter for the Boston Globe, thanks so much for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Always fun.
And John Carroll, communications professor at BU and the blogger behind CampaignOutsider.com. Good weekend to you as well, John.
Thank you. To you both.
And stay with us. Coming up, we peer into a window of opportunity that the mayor's race has created for education reform in Boston. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Sharon Brody. This is Radio Boston.